May it please the court, my name is Jim Birch. I'm here today on behalf of Rick and Patsy Bly and Bank of the West, which holds the mortgage on the Bly's property. The Bly's own a secluded mountain property near Evergreen, which they purchased in the mid-1980s. And Tamara Story purchased an adjacent parcel several years ago and filed a petition for condemnation to acquire an access easement through the Bly's property over an existing road. Story says in her answer brief in a number of places that the Bly's knew all along that she only sought use for one house, access in order to use her property for one house, and that's not true. There's a requirement under Colorado law, which we mentioned in our briefing, for good faith negotiations prior to trying to file a condemnation petition. And the condemnor is required to make an effort, a good faith effort, to purchase what the condemnor wants voluntarily from the landowner. And we've cited in the briefing a June 2005 letter from condemnor Story's counsel saying she would like to purchase access for all uses of her property consistent with the zoning. There's also a last written offer in the record, and there's a statutory basis for that. There's a statute that refers to the need for a last written offer before filing a condemnation case. And that last written offer, Story asked the Bly's if they would sell to her an access across the road in order to reach her property, quote, for purposes of a single family residence and any other uses allowed by the Jefferson County Zoning Code.
Counsel, can I stop you there? How does that relate, though, to the case? Your point that you didn't, I mean, let's just assume that's true. You didn't realize that she was just going to use it for one house. How does that relate to the larger argument?
Then the Bly's understood that Story wanted use for every conceivable use under the zoning code, which is a very broad uses. Story then proceeded to file a petition, which is essentially blank. It doesn't say what uses she wants. It just says, I want use and enjoyment of my property. The petition, under the statutes, the petition controls what the landowner is paid, what the jury verdict is relates to, what is set forth in the petition, what uses and purposes are asked for, and the petition also controls, at the end of the case, what is conveyed to the condemnor for property interest.
I mean, maybe I had my facts wrong, but I thought that 6 months after the petition was filed and 1 year before the trial with respect to damages, you got your specific answer, not only about the use, but also the legal description.
We
so
got,
I kind of echo Justice Hyde. What difference does it make?
We got an answer, and just to fill in the court to how we got there, we filed our motion to dismiss because...
Well, however you got there, what difference does it actually make in the proceeding? I'm sure you forced it by discovery. I don't doubt that.
We forced it by discovery, and we got a series of comments of our use, and that the intended use includes one house. Our view was, and we think there's a basis for this in the statute, Your Honor, that if you have a use in mind, you need to put it in the operative pleading. You need to put it in your petition, and they did not move to amend.
Well, that's probably, you know, it's hard to argue with that as a general proposition, but why does it matter?
It matters because it matters for several reasons, Your Honor. First, the Bly's...
I mean, now in this case, why does it matter?
Right now, today, it matters because the Bly's incurred attorney fees getting to that point and extracting basic information that should be provided in every petition. And...
But what would be the remedy? Let's assume.
And it also matters because the condemnor never negotiated. There's a good faith negotiation requirement, which is jurisdictional. Condemnor never negotiated for use for just one house.
So we should send this back because of that problem? You know,
At this point, Your Honor, 4 years ago? Right. At this point, Your Honor, what we're saying in our briefing essentially is that there may be changed circumstances. Condemnor Story took a course of action, a deliberate course of action, deciding not to move to amend her petition and deciding to stand on the petition and say that's sufficient. If it's not sufficient, we've had 4 years of litigation. During that four-year period of time, circumstances may have changed. There may be another route available to Condemnor Story, or at a minimum, The cost of construction has come down, and the Blighs maybe should be allowed to show that they can impose another route through their own property, because the cost of that route does not exceed the value of condom or storage property.
Mr. Birx, let me back up a little bit. You have said that if they have a specific use in mind, they should put it in the petition. But isn't your argument really dependent on they must put something specific in the petition, regardless of whether they have it in mind or not? In other words, your argument is the rule requires it, not it would be nice for them to do it if they're able to.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The statute requires
it.
I misspoke. Can you tell me how you are interpreting the statute specifically? That is, what specifically does it require? In general terms, I know what you think it requires in this particular case, but how are you reading those words that it has the specificity to it? What is that specificity?
The specificity is that it requires that the condom nor identify the uses and purposes for which the taking is occurring, and also provide a description, and in our view that requires a description which is sufficient to do an appraisal.
And what is the effect of that requirement? Setting aside I understand your argument of it took you way long time to get this figured out, but if she had specified that this is an access over the existing road for one house and one house only, what would be the effect of that? Does that mean that at some time in the future, if she decided to subdivide the property and put in the number of houses permitted, that then you'd be entitled to further, if she wanted access over the same road, you'd be entitled to further costs? Or I'm just not sure what the effect of it is.
The effect is that in this eminent domain proceeding, she would only be granted a right, if she was clear up front, she would only be granted a right for access for one house. And she would need to condemn later if she chose, I suppose, to subdivide and build four houses, or if she chose to do some other use that didn't require subdivision that she could do today.
And would your client then, assuming that had been done that way and the use was accelerated at a later point in time, your client would be entitled to damages of some sort, or what would be the effect?
Client would be entitled to additional money, and I don't know whether you'd phrase it as damages or value for the taking, probably both. Definitely damages, because there would be a greater impact the more traffic you have across it. We had a damages theory that went to the jury, and the jury awarded over $9,000 in damages, presumably on that theory. And that theory was the more traffic you have across the road, the more impact you have on the value of the remainder parcel, because it becomes less secluded, less private, not as quiet and peaceable. And that in the marketplace translates into a lower dollar value. The problem, Your Honor, with this ruling by the Court of Appeals is that it takes what once was simple. Condominiums routinely just stated their uses and their purposes in the condemnation petition. It takes what once was simple and turns it into something which now will be litigated. It puts a burden on landowners whose property is being involuntarily taken from them to come forward and litigate this, and it puts a burden on the courts to decide at what point. Is it a month before trial you're entitled to this information?
The neighbor disputes in the mountains are never simple. I mean, but the point is that there are other people that enjoy this right-of-way as well, right?
There's one other family that uses the right-of-way, and there is a debate in the briefing as to whether that's an easement. Our view is that it's a revocable license, and the evidence at trial was that they had not been using it yet for the statutory period of adverse possession, and Story's counsel put on evidence to show that Story believed she would be subject to attorney fee liability if she raised the argument that the owner of both Story's parcel and McClintock parcel had acquired any right to use the Blighs Road. Didn't believe she could prove that they had acquired any right.
Well, here's my point, though. Coming back to the statute, the statute is fairly general. petition setting forth by reference his authority in the premises, the purpose for which said property is sought to be taken or damaged, a description of the property.
It is.
That's not detailed pleading that requires you to do anything other than, apparently, launch what, you know, is typical in most situations. The facts are filled in as to what the dimension of the burden is here on the property owner. The burden of this servitude, easement, right-of-way, however you characterize, I guess we've called it different things over the decades. But the point is, the lawful zoned property, purely on the record, as I understand it, in the clerk and recorder's office, is that it's single-family residence. Is that true or not?
That's simply not true, Your Honor.
Okay.
The zoning is very broad on this property. It's A2 zoning, which was discussed in the Bear Creek case, which we cited, and has not changed since Bear Creek. And the A2 zoning regulations themselves, the zoning code, is in the record. It's attached to Story's appraiser's report, to Early's report, and we've cited it in our briefing. And it allows a variety of uses, farming, ranching, commercial uses, and those uses Story could do today if she so chose. She could. The only one that requires an additional step would be turning this into and subdividing this and using it, you know, dividing it into four parcels and having four houses on it. But the law is that that's irrelevant, legally irrelevant to what she can condemn for. She doesn't need to get her subdivision approvals first. She can condemn. There's also evidence in the record. We don't know whether Story wants to keep this property for her own uses, sell it to a developer, sell it to somebody else.
Stay with me, though. Let's assume then, because this does affect the valuation and the method of valuation and the damages. She took, apparently, at least, that's their view, at least a self-limitation on how she would use this if the court were to allow the condemnation.
Ultimately, she did, and at a minimum, we think we're entitled to our attorney fees incurred up to that point. And our attorney fees to this point, really, I mean, it took us a while to get from there to here to argue what we think is a very basic
principle.
Now, the
court denied those attorney fees?
The court did.
On what reasoning?
It was just a simple one sentence. I deny the motion for attorney fees.
Let me ask you about the petition itself. I'm looking at the general allegations, and I guess I have a little trouble with your assertion that you couldn't figure out what the case was about until after some discovery, because if I look at these general allegations, it seems fairly clear to me that they're asking for the use of a private right-of-way as a result of being landlocked and in order to access their property and to permit use and enjoyment of that property being their property. There's a map attached that shows the road. Why isn't that sufficient under the statute?
It's not sufficient because under the statute, and there's one more statutory provision that we've cited, 381105, actually several subsections that say you get at the end of the case what it is you asked for in your petition. And traditionally, throughout condemnation practice, that has been you specify in your petition what it is you want. In fact, you have to negotiate it for it first before you file.
Excuse me. So at the end of their petition, they say they want an order of immediate possession in her favor to allow her access across the access road described in paragraph 9 above. Paragraph 9 above describes 20-foot wide easement and which crosses the Servient property and provides physical assets access to the Story property. And you look at the map and you can see exactly what that is.
Well, you don't see exactly what use they want because there's no use identified, Your Honor. And
well, the use identified is in paragraph 12, the private way of necessity requested by Story will not interfere. They need it because they're landlocked. That's paragraph 8.
Your Honor, I think both lower courts assumed implicitly and maybe expressly, I think the Court of Appeals at least implicitly acknowledged that this was insufficient information to conduct an appraisal.
Well, I guess I'm testing that with you because your assumption seems to be that it was insufficient and that was the Court of Appeals' assumption as well, but if you just read it, I can't imagine what they might have said in discovery that would make that more specific. Some negatives, and we don't want it for this, and we don't want it for that. That seems to be your argument.
Well, as it stands now, Your Honor, it could be anything. It could be any use.
Well, tell me what additional information you were given by way of discovery so late in the case, as you say, that made it finally clear. And as a result, you think you now need to have attorney's fees. What specifically was said?
To be perfectly frank, Your Honor, we didn't think there was any information that we got that finally did it for us, because we thought it had to be in the statute, that the statute required it to be in the petition.
Well, I thought I understood you to say earlier that you did finally understand about after 18 months what this condemnation was for, but now you thought you were entitled to attorney's fees because it took so long.
Well, what happened was the trial court entered an order that said, this is going to be it. You're going to get one house in perpetuity. We didn't think that was sufficient under the statutes, but we certainly didn't think that statements from the condemnor about we're willing to limit it to a use that includes one residence was sufficient. The appraisers in this case were not able to complete an appraisal. I mean, even Condemnor Story's appraiser admitted that he wasn't able to finalize his appraisal in advance of the immediate possession hearing because he didn't have enough information, and that's a constitutional right for the landowners to be able, under Article 2, Section 15, they are required to be able to pay, they need to be paid just compensation before the condemnor takes possession. And in order to do that, you need to set a security deposit. In order to do that, you need information sufficient to do an appraisal. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
No, but you can move on. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Let's move on and talk about the cost method of appraisal for just a few moments. Story's expert essentially concluded that the roadway itself, this finished roadway improvement on top of the raw land, contributed zero value to the property. And we think there's evidence in the record, certainly, that that's not true, that common sense dictates that anyone would pay more for an easement across a property, particularly in a mountainous forested area that has an existing road on it, than one an easement across raw land.
Counsel, can I stop you there and just ask, I thought their position was that they looked at comparable sales with, you know, properties with roads and properties without roads. I guess, are you saying that their conclusion was that the properties with roads sold for the same price as properties without roads?
The appraisal process was a two-step process. First, the appraisers looked at the value of the raw land underlying the road. And to do that, they looked at, there were comparable sales of raw land of approximately 80-acre parcels, which is roughly the size that's affected here of the Bly parcel. And some of those, there was an offhand reference in the record to some of those parcels did not have an existing internal driveway, and some did. But there was no evidence whatsoever as to what anyone paid to acquire an easement in an existing driveway. There was no evidence of that, and there were no comparable sales of acquiring an easement to use an existing driveway. There was some evidence, and I think our appraiser testified that there were one or two parcels at least that did not have an internal driveway when he was looking at comparable sales for the raw land underlying the road. And he pointed out that the purchaser on those purchases ultimately had to expend a substantial amount of money to build an internal road. But the trial court precluded us from connecting that with the value of the Bly's roadway improvement in this case. She said, you're not going to get anything, you're not going to get any money at all for the value of that roadway improvement. And she did not allow us to connect that with either the appraiser or through legal argument. So we had this free-floating comments in front of the jury about roads are expensive, but we're not allowed to tie that to why the Bly should get paid something towards the value of the improvement itself that's being taken.
Excuse me, what's the length of this road approximately?
About 3/5 of a mile long, Your Honor.
Okay. And that traverses an 80-acre parcel? Is that what you're saying?
The part of the Bly's parcel that is affected is an 80-acre parcel, and the appraisers both agreed it was an 80-acre parcel that you'd be looking at. So it's a two-step process in the analysis. That's the first step in the appraisal analysis, and we've submitted, I think, some excerpts from the appraisal treatise that you do. First, you look at the raw land, you look at comparable sales, and then you look at the value of the improvement, usually through the cost method, and you add that value of the improvement to the value of the raw land to get the value of the thing that's being taken. And we were precluded from doing a second step. Essentially, Story's appraiser prevailed, and his view prevailed, that all Story needed to do was pay for an easement across raw land. Didn't need to pay an extra dime for there being an existing roadway there, even though roadways are extremely expensive to build, particularly in the mountain area. It costs a lot of money to carve out a roadway, to cut down trees and carve out a roadway. The standard is, and you can find this in the jury instruction, CJI 36:3, for valuation, the value is what a purchaser in the open marketplace would typically pay under ordinary circumstances. So you'd look at what would a purchaser pay who was going out to buy a driveway easement. Would they pay something more for a driveway easement? They're looking for a similar one, 3/5 of a mile long in a mountainous area, forested. Would they pay something more for a driveway easement that already has an existing roadway on it than they would for raw land? You think, of course they would.
But what road had, no road had to be built?
No road had to be built.
So why are we talking about how much it would cost to build a road? I get so confused by this, because if you look at the petition, the road is already there. And what they want to do is just simply have the easement or a right of access.
The road is there, Your Honor.
So why would you look to comparables for building roads if you don't need to do that?
There are no comparable sales of driveway easements. There are three methods that have been approved by this court in the Berkman case, which we've cited. Comparable sales, income method, and cost method, and he couldn't use the other two methods. There were no comparable sales of driveway easements. There were no indications of data available for anyone who rents out a driveway easement. So you're stuck with, the only thing left is the cost method. I think the Court of Appeals misunderstood the fact that...
Tell me why, just logically, the only thing you're left with is the cost. I mean, if a comparable doesn't match up, then it's not a comparable. And in fact, you didn't have the cost of building a road.
I'm not sure I understand.
So legally, that might make some analytical sense, but it doesn't just in terms of if we look at the ground here, does it?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor. If a comparable doesn't match up, what?
A comparable is supposed to compare things.
A comparable sale.
Right, right. And so yes. If it's not comparable, it's not helpful. It's not very good evidence. It might be admissible, but it's not very good evidence.
You're referring to the cost method?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, we've cited in our brief that the Appraisal Institute has adopted the cost method, and this court adopted the cost method in the Bergman case as an acceptable method for finding market value. I think, and I think I may understand where you're going here, Your Honor, and I think it's the same place that the trial court went, and I believe the Court of Appeals went as well. The trial court thought that in order to show market value, you needed to have sales data. And it's true the cost method will not give you sales data. Only the comparable sales method will give you comparable sales of similar properties in the area. But there were no comparable sales here. And as the Appraisal Institute says, when there are no comparable sales and there is no income method applicable, the cost method is very valuable and should be applied. So we look to the cost method. The Court of Appeals essentially said, well, you're not out of pocket any money. But eminent domain and just compensation in an eminent domain case is very different from an ordinary civil case. In an ordinary civil case, a torts case, you crash into my car and I sue you. And so you crashed into my car and I am out of pocket. These expenditures reimburse me. And the Court of Appeals seemed to think that we need to show out-of-pocket expenses that need to be reimbursed. But that's not the way the just compensation statutes and the just compensation valuation works in Colorado. You're entitled to, the landowner when the property is taken, is entitled to damages to the remainder property, in this case the property outside the ribbon of land that's being taken for the easement. in this case, it was a decrease in privacy and a decrease in seclusion, and we got damages for that. But you're also entitled to the value of the thing that's being taken. Whether you spend any money as a landowner or not, whether you expended any money out of pocket, you're entitled to the value of the thing that is being taken. The thing that is being taken here is the use of raw land and the use of an existing roadway. And since there were no comparable sales to look at for acquiring easements in raw land, the only thing that's left to try to get at the inherent value of what that roadway is worth is to look at the cost of construction and then prorate that. Court of Appeals said you can't do that because they're not taking a fee simple interest, but our appraiser did what appraisers do all the time when an easement is taken. They take the cost of construction and then they prorate it down. Our appraiser applied a 33% value to that and said Story should be paying at least 33% of the cost of construction. That's how you get at the inherent value.
And that evidence was not allowed, is that what you're saying?
That was definitely not allowed.
So that counters our recent case involving the Brighton Road and the value. Our rules apparently of evidence favor all the potential value that a landowner might have. So what you're basically saying is that they get a benefit of this construction that was made possible by, in effect, the predecessors and title of your clients.
That's right. Right. So they get a windfall. It's true the Blys did not personally go out there and construct the road, but they purchased that roadway improvement as part of the parcel when they purchased the whole thing. It belongs to them. If somebody wants to use it, they have to pay for that, just like they have to pay for using the raw land underneath.
Could I ask you just one question? I didn't pick that exactly. And so your expert would have testified actually to a proportion of the cost that would be a reasonable formula for deciding what the value of this easement would be?
The value of the contributory value of the roadway improvement added to the value of the easement in the raw land. That's correct, Your Honor. And there can be a debate as to what the percentage is, but that goes to weight.
And I was going to say, and just to, because I would have no idea, what's the basis for that kind of an opinion? Would he compare what the cost of roads in other situations were to what the ultimate value of the easement turned out to be in terms of an award?
He could do that, and actually, Your Honor, much of this is judgment on the part of the appraiser, but it is done all the time, and it was done by both appraisers with respect to the raw land. They had a disagreement as to what percentage to apply to allocate, but they both realize this is not a fee simple taking in raw land underneath the roadway improvement, so we need to have some sort of percentage. There was a dispute about that, and that dispute went to the jury, and the jury ultimately decides what weight to give in terms of what percentage. But appraisers do this all the time. It is standard practice. It is very typical, very standard practice with respect to the taking of easements. If there are no other questions, I'll save what time remains for rebuttal. Thank you.
Chief Justice Mularkey, may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Jeff Anderson. I'm with the firm Burns, Fiege & Will. I represent the respondent here, Tamara Story. She's with us in the audience here today. Well, I think we have the court granted cert on two issues. I think the first one has two sub-issues, and the second one is the cost issue. So let's start with the first one, the description of the property. Those two sub-issues are the use of the property and the legal description of the location of the road. Starting with the location of the road, I think that the condemnation statutes, as some members of the court indicated in the argument by Mr. Birch, does not require a meets and bounds legal description to be set forth in the petition. The statute simply doesn't say that. It requires only a description. Now, there's no reported decision in 130 years of the statute's existence that's dismissed a petition for lack of a meets and bounds description where the property is otherwise accurately described, as it was here with the map and the verbal description in the petition. The Colorado legislature has amended this statute numerous times over the course of its existence, and several times even within the last decade and hasn't amended this portion of it to require a meets and bounds description. There have been amendments in 2006, in 04, and 03. Back in 1985, there were some more. Now, I think that the term legal description, which of course doesn't appear here, is a term of art. It means a specific description with specific bearings and distances, allowing a surveyor to plot the boundaries on the ground. If the legislature wanted to require that in petitions, it could have easily said so by inserting the word legal before description in section 102, but it didn't. And after 130 years, it still hasn't. The question is whether the description in this case was adequate, and I think the answer is clearly yes. Now, the Blys suffered no prejudice by the fact that there wasn't a legal description in the petition, because that was the only access road leading to Mrs. Story's property. It's the same access road the Blys used to get to their house, which is nearby. Mr. Bly testified at the immediate possession hearing and the motion to dismiss hearing. That was one hearing. Those two issues were brought up. He testified at that hearing that he knew what Mrs. Story wanted. He repeated that testimony under oath a year later at the compensation trial. The map that Justice Rice was pointing to is a USGS map, United States Geological Survey. It shows the road right there on the map. The road's been there for many decades, maybe 100 years or more, but certainly it's been there for a long time, and the Blys knew right where it was. Now, the Blys mention Platte River Power Authority versus Nelson. That's a Colorado Court of Appeals case from 1998. Where a petition was dismissed for an inadequate description. But that had no description at all of where the access easements were going to be. Platte River Power Authority was condemning a right-of-way for a power line, and then it wanted some access easements from roads across some of the condemned property to get to the power line easement for maintenance purposes. Those descriptions were not specified at all. Nobody had any idea where those were going to be, and the Court of Appeals upheld the dismissal of the petition in that case. That's not what we have here, though, because of the adequate description in the petition using the map and Mr. Bly's understanding, as he stated under oath more than once, that
what is your view of the law with respect to let's say this property was capable of being subdivided, and whether or not there has to be a new condemnation if there's a new value, let's say, added and new burdens put on the right of way?
Okay, now that's the use issue,
right?
And so I'd be happy to talk about that. I think you have to look at easement law for the answer to those types of questions. And this court has many cases on easement law and overburdening easements. For example, there's Wright versus Horse Creek Ranches from about 1985, where the use was being changed from an agricultural use to a residential use. And the bottom line there was going to be more traffic on the easement. And that particular easement was created by prescriptive use. So a prescriptive use arose by agricultural use, and then somebody wanted to change and build a house up there and start driving up and down the easement more often. And this court said, no, you can't do that. You're expanding the easement. So if you have an easement for one house, you can't expand it without permission of the landowner to two houses or four houses or more houses like that, because you would be overburdening the easement. That's simple easement law right there. So the point that we were making in our brief and in the petition was that Mrs. Story had an actual right at that time, still does, to build only one house. The Blys say, well, she could subdivide and she could build four houses. Well, if she could subdivide, she has to go through that whole process. That's another step. The point we were making is, what does she have a right to do? The highest and best use of that property is to put one single-family house,
which is not built yet.
No, it's not built yet.
Okay. What does the award, the condemnation award, does it contain this limitation?
Yes.
For a single-family?
Indeed, it does.
Residence.
Mr. Anderson, yes, can you explain something to me that I quite don't get? If the test is the use of the property is whether or not it can be appraised, and your appraiser said, I didn't have enough information from the petition. Well, let's assume you did. That's not really where I'm going. I don't understand why it couldn't be appraised as the highest and best use for that zone. You know, A2, whatever it is, A2, which would include four homes and all kinds of commercial, whatever, ranching activity. Why couldn't that be appraised at that, on that basis?
Well, you could appraise it if you wanted to. The fact is that we didn't, because
well,
we didn't want to use it
for more. But technically, according to your petition, as far as the description of the use was concerned, it says for whatever enjoyment you're entitled to, right?
Which she had a right to do, which at that time, a right to build one house.
Why is it? I guess I don't understand that. I thought it was consistent with zoning.
Well, she would have to rezone the property.
I thought it was A2 zoning, which gave her the right to...
Not, it's a 40-acre tract, roughly.
So they had four houses, is what I read from the briefs.
It's a single 40-acre tract, and that particular zoning allows one house on a 40-acre tract. It would have to be split up into four separate tracts.
I see, you're giving
and then
the
you could put one house on each tract. And that's a whole process with Jefferson County, which is notoriously difficult to deal with. They have a lot of requirements, and it's not easy. So when
but it could have been appraised, forgetting the, with respect to step two and three of the zoning process, to the highest and best use that it could theoretically be put to, right?
Well, the appraisal will appraise what you ask them to appraise. And so if you ask them to appraise the value of the road for four houses, he would do that. We only wanted one house. That's what we asked him to do. And by the way, we got an appraisal on this before we even sent the letter requesting to buy the easement, because we wanted to know from an authority, an appraiser, rather than just guesswork from non-appraisers, us, what the value of the property was. So Mr. Early went out and did an appraisal before we even sent that first letter offering to buy the easement, so we would have an idea what kind of range we should be talking about. And he came in with an estimate of about $900, I think, at that time. And then he later revised the appraisal because a year or two had passed, and at that time, unlike now, property values were going up pretty fast, and so he had to raise that a little bit.
Could you make sure that we understand the difference between the zoning of the property, which at this point was one house for 40 acres, and that's all she was asking for, and the burden on the easement, and when that easement would become overburdened?
Well, it's as I mentioned earlier, is that we asked for an access easement to access one single-family house. One house will generate a certain amount of vehicular traffic on an access road. Four houses would generate, all things being equal, four times that much. So that's an additional burden on the serving the state.
So
in this case,
if Jefferson County revised the zoning to allow four houses, there were four times the amount of traffic, then the easement would be overburdened.
Right, and I think the Blys would have the ability, they'd certainly be within their rights to object to that.
Right. That's not the situation now.
Not at all.
Okay.
Judge, as to the issue of the sufficiency of the petition with regard to the purpose and use, I don't think clearly the petition didn't on its face and its four corners make it clear that the purpose was for one residence, correct?
That term, one residence, is not in the petition. That's correct.
And so your argument seems to be, and help me understand this or correct it, that that the current zoning requirements with respect to one residence per tract is somehow implicit in the petition and helps the petition to be sufficient, or are you instead arguing that sufficiency does not require the distinction between one dwelling or several,
well,
as far as the use and purpose is concerned?
The language about the use for zoning comes from this Bear Creek development versus Genesee case. That's the case that I was taking a look at when I was drafting the petition, and that says that a condemned way can be, or you can condemn an access way for purposes consistent with the zoning. The statute itself doesn't say that. The statute, as I believe Justice Hobbs pointed out, is fairly vague. It's just for the purposes. And I think it's important to read that in context, because if you look at Section 102, which provides the power to do this, Section 102 says that parties can condemn private property for all sorts of things: railroads, toll roads, bridges, ferries, telegraphs, reservoirs, drains, flumes, ditches, and private ways of necessity. I think that's what the statute says, or it means when it says, tell us what your use is going to be. That's your list of possibilities that you can condemn private property for. So pick one. Well, we did. We picked private ways of necessity. She needs access to get to her property. That's all that the statute requires. If you read the whole thing, you can see how it all meshes. The idea that you have to get down to the level of detail that the Blys are talking about is something that has never been required before by this court or by the Colorado Court of Appeals or any other reported decision in this state.
Well, how is the subservient landowner supposed to know what type of an easement she wants if it doesn't specify that she wants it over the existing road? There are a lot of different ways to get to the access to the, I mean, the adjoining highway, whatever it is, highway, county road, whatever it is.
Not in this case.
Why
no, this is in the foothills and the topography.
Well, I mean, she could, just from your map, she could have cut the somewhere else through his through their
doesn't,
property.
Doesn't
in
your
theory?
Doesn't your petition say that you want to use that road?
Yes, it does.
To condemn a 20-foot wide easement over and across an existing dirt road.
Right, and that's why we attached the U.S. Geological Survey map, because that road appears on the map. If you look at the map closely, you can see that it parallels drainage, and that's where roads are typically built. You build them next to the river so that you have the easiest grade to go up the hill. Justice Malarkey, it's true that theoretically she could build a road across anywhere, but that would cause much disruption to the Bly's property, the Servian estate. If she took on some big cut and fill project to slice a road into the side of the hill, there's also the problem of Jefferson County. They like to keep track of these sorts of things and keep the environmental disruption to a minimum. There's simply no point in disrupting the environment up there by cutting a whole new road when there is already a long time road that goes right to where Mrs. Story wants to get, which is right to her property. So, in theory, sure, you could build another road. As a practical matter, it really doesn't make any sense.
Are you ready to move now to the valuation? Because it seems to me a pretty good argument was made there that there's a windfall to your client here by not having to, account for what it would cost her to build a new road.
Oh, no.
That is value by owned by the landowner here.
I think it's a windfall to the Blys, because they didn't build the road. They bought
the
property.
They paid for it when they bought the road.
Well, that's only a theory. There was no evidence submitted at all. There was no evidence submitted that
they
paid anything.
Well, it was 100 years. Didn't you have evidence that it was a 100-year road and all that?
Well, the road clearly existed when they bought the property.
So, therefore, they obviously paid for it.
But they own the surrounding estate. I mean, so why isn't that a value of the surrounding estate? A right-of-way is simply, a partial interest, to get in the property. The underlying property owner still enjoys the full right of use, right? I mean, isn't that the law? I mean, so haven't you really discounted the value? They didn't get a fair shot of the evidentiary value of an existing road in the mountains?
No, not at all.
Okay, explain why.
Okay, well, first of all, what we're talking about is Mr. Haggerty's evidence on the cost approach. That's what the trial court ruled on. And what the job for this court is to decide whether the trial court in this case abused its discretion in keeping this evidence out. And the answer to that is no, the trial court did not abuse its discretion, because Mr. Haggerty's information just had no relationship at all to the value that the Blys were losing.
Well, let's get kind of specific here. So what his expert said is, I figure it would cost X to build a road, and so you're entitled to one-third X. Is that right?
That's what he said. That's okay. Right.
We're talking about one-third X. And so why is that either not admissible under 401 or prejudicial under 403?
Because there's no connection between the cost to build the road and the value of the road. And the example that the trial court used was remodeling your kitchen. You can spend $50,000 to remodel your kitchen, but it doesn't mean that the value of your house went up by $50,000. It may have gone up somewhat, but it's a different number. It's what the market will bear. That's the piece that was missing in Mr. Haggerty's evaluation. There's no connection at all between the cost to build the road and the value of the road. One thing that he looked at was the advantage to Mrs. Story, and that's inappropriate under this court's jurisprudence.
Isn't that, to some extent, always true with cost analysis, which is why it usually is the third alternative?
That
the connection, maybe not, there's absolutely no connection, but the connection between the cost of building it is weak in terms of the relationship to the value of the property.
Well, I think it's terribly weak in an easement situation, because as we point out, the improvements aren't being taken away from the Blys. This is not a case where the highway is coming through their house and we're going to kick them out of their house and they're never going to be able to use it again. They can still use the road just as they always have. So you can't say that they lost $100,000 worth of value because the house was worth $100,000 and now they can't use it anymore. They can still continue to use it.
Oh, wouldn't that be like an argument? I mean, it's really an admissibility question. So maybe instead of 1/3 X, it should have been, I don't know, 1/10 X, because they built this road 100 years ago and so forth, and they're still using it.
Well,
it's a weight kind of argument, not an admissibility, right?
I don't think that's right, because I think the trial court has to have some control over expert testimony like this. I don't think that the rules of expert testimony go out the window just because this is an appraisal or just because this is a condemnation case. The trial court still can have some authority to say, boy, that testimony is so far out, it just doesn't help at all. It's prejudicial. That's what it was here. It was prejudicial. And then,
which is what I was trying to get to. I'm sorry. Are you making the argument that it's not probative at all, or are you instead making the argument that it may have minimal probative value, but it's prejudicial in some way, and specifically, how?
Both. It's not probative at all, because there's no connection between the cost to build a road and the value of the road. Mr. Agnew,
expert testimony? Is that what the trial judge was doing here? Was the trial judge saying, as an expert, you haven't laid any foundation to show why 1/3 of the value of building the road would reflect something about the value?
That's exactly right. I mean, it's opinion evidence. So, of course, it's expert. He went out and he did an investigation, and he came back, and he was going to tell the jury what he found out in his investigation.
Well, I think I'm going to be sorry I ever started down this 1/3 X business, but let me stay with that. And so what the trial judge really said is just X isn't relevant at all. It could be 1/3, 1/5, 1/8 X, but it doesn't matter. X is inadmissible, the cost of the road, because it bears no reasonable relationship to the evidentiary issue here. Is that what you're trying to say?
That's right.
What did the judge say specifically?
The judge said specifically that there was no connection between the cost to build the road and the value of the road that Mrs. Story was taking. And that's where she used her example of the kitchen. You can put in X dollars for the kitchen, but that doesn't mean you get X dollars back when you sell the house.
Okay.
It goes to the market value of the property being taken, and here there was no connection between the two. I'd like to go back and challenge an assumption that Mr. Birch made, and that was that, gosh, if you go out to buy a road in the mountains, you're going to have to pay for the improvement. That's not necessarily the case with roads in the mountains. There may be situations out there, and there probably are, that people that own roads in the mountains would be happy to have somebody else use their road with them. And the reason is this: they get assistance with the maintenance cost. The mountains of Colorado are difficult places to maintain roads like this. They wash out. We have our monsoon floods on the Front Range in July, Big Thompson flood, the floods in Denver in the 1960s. We have lots of snow in the wintertime, lots of runoff in the springtime. Lots of roads require significant amount of maintenance every single year just because of the natural elements, and it has nothing to do with the use of the road. Somebody that's struggling to keep one of those roads up may say, oh yeah, I'd love to have you come in here and use the road if you split the maintenance costs with me 50-50. And they're not going to be charging for the
isn't
that
road. Just something that can go to the jury? I mean, really, why shouldn't it have gone to the jury that this was how much it would cost to build this type of road? This is how much her contribution would be as sharing maintenance.
Because it's baseless. It's baseless evidence.
It's not baseless.
Oh, sure.
You don't like it, but it's not baseless.
Well, that's true.
I mean, the fact that they're, I think that example of the kitchen makes no sense whatsoever to me, because a house is more valuable with a kitchen without a kitchen than without a kitchen. And whether you think that you wanted to buy a $50,000 kitchen as opposed to a $2 kitchen, I mean, that really is not relevant to me. Whether this road is too fancy for your client, for example, isn't very relevant. Is it? It's the road that's there.
It's the road that's there. And that brings up a good point, is that Mr. Haggerty did not consider the depreciation. I mean, a lot of cases
that doesn't go to the admissibility of his evidence.
Sure it does.
Why?
Because it was unreliable. It was unreliable evidence. It was so bad it was unreliable and should have been kept out from the jury.
Are you saying by that the expert offered no basis for it?
Right.
Is that why it's unreliable?
That's right. That's so right.
He didn't make any attempt to justify why he thought one-third of the cost of building the road would be a reasonable estimate of what it would be, of what its value would be?
He just said that one-third was a good number because there'd be three users of the road, the Blys, okay, Mrs. Story,
and other users. So that was his rationale.
Right, right. But but it didn't go to the value to the Blys. What is the
no,
value
no
to the Blys?
No comparison with other roads or the cost of them and the amount that was...
Nothing, nothing, nothing. Look,
could I just ask you a question? We keep interrupting you. So if you pay for the value of an easement, it might make perfect sense that there would be an advantage in terms of sharing subsequent costs of maintaining that road.
Right.
But how does condemnation law allow that subsequent sharing of costs to be factored in? Doesn't that then have to somehow be a private contract between the parties? Or how does that actually work?
That's engrafted by easement law, because what we want
so
here
can
is
you tell
easement.
Me about that, please?
The restatement of property that deals with easements says that in the absence of anything else, the people that use the road should share in the maintenance.
So when you buy an easement, you buy the duty or the burden of helping to maintain it?
Well, sure. Sure, if you're going to use something, you have to help put it together. I mean, that's common sense.
Yeah, the only enforcement to that is a lawsuit, however, if the neighbor refuses, right? I mean, right?
That's typical, unless you're in the foothills, and these things get difficult. No, sir, that's right.
But it's part of the right of the property right is to require contribution to the maintenance.
Right.
You have to undertake the maintenance yourself to serve your own purpose, and then you're trying to get back. I mean, I think Justice Rice asked how it worked. Isn't that the ultimate remedy? You have to go back to a court of law if the neighbors aren't cooperating in the absence of an agreement, you know, that resolves this. Correct?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So the real question is given that you're going to continue to maintain this road in the future, you have to, how much benefit is there to you that the road existed in the first place? And you're saying there might be some, but this expert testimony was inadequate. What kind of testimony, just hypothetically, would have been adequate?
The benefit to the condemning party cannot be used in considering the amount of the condemnation award, and this court has said that many times. City of Englewood versus Weist is a case that says that. So, and that's a place where Mr. Haggerty came off the track. I mean, we cite his rebuttal report where he specifically references.
I understand you maybe don't want to go where I was hoping you would, but what kind of testimony would be appropriate? Just trying to think this through.
Something in the cost approach in the context here, I think something that would show that there was some connection between the cost of the road and the value to the Blys. What are the Blys going to lose for their improvement by the use of this? And the answer is, everything tells us, nothing. I mean, we've got the comparable sales approach. The appraisers couldn't find any comparable sales. That means there's no market for that.
There's two additional cars going
Zero.
By, right? They go by day and night, you know, because of their jobs. Or, you know, they invite friends, you know, to come visit them. Now, you know, how is that taken into account under your approach that it's zero value?
That's the damage to the residue. That's the damage to the surrounding property, and that was taken into account. As Mr. Birch indicated, the jury awarded about $9,000 for the cars going by. So that doesn't have anything to do with
it. That's the aesthetic value, but not the value for the cost of the road itself. How is that taken care of?
Well,
you know, that's the use and enjoyment, the $9,000. We're not talking about
right, that. Right, right, right. The contributory value of the road was zero.
Well, help us with that.
It doesn't make
well,
sense.
As I mentioned, there's no market for this. For things that there's no market for, the value of those things is zero. The income approach is the other one. What income does it generate? Nothing. It's zero. And there's no evidence that links up the cost to build this road with the value. That's why it's nothing. The trial court got to the right place with this. But keep in mind, we're looking at Mr. Haggerty's expert opinion here and whether that should have come in.
What did your experts say as to why there is no value? Well, could you summarize that?
Because he couldn't find anything.
Well, I'm talking about on the direct cost method.
Well, he didn't think it's appropriate because you can't link it up with the value of the road. It's the problem with the easement situation. The Blys still continue to use it. The only way that you can make this cost work is to look at the advantage to Ms. Story. Well, gosh, she saved a bunch of money because she didn't have to build the road. That's not the measure of damages. This court has said that many times.
About the attorney's fees issue, didn't they have to extract this out of your client as to his limitation?
Not at all.
No? Explain that.
Well, they accuse us of hardball, hide the ball tactics, that sort of thing. The petition was filed in March of 2006. We did Ms. Story's deposition in May, 2 months later. That is almost impossible to do under the rules of civil procedure without the agreement of parties to do it that quickly. And they filed a motion to dismiss. I don't think the case was even really at issue, but we agreed to the deposition. They asked her what she wanted to use the road for. She told them what she wanted to use the road for. So the idea that attorney's fees ought to be awarded here just makes no sense at all. The petition was adequate for both the use and location. And Justice Hobbs, I wanted to follow up on something you said earlier about how neighbor disputes in the mountains are difficult. Well, they are, and tensions run high. And that's one reason that when you have high tensions, you don't want to just blast in there with the survey crew. It's much better to try to keep the emotions in check by having a lawsuit set up. There's going to be an opposing counsel. I can call them up on the phone and say, look, we have to do this. Can we arrange a time when maybe your guy's not there so we can have the survey crew come in and try to keep a lid on the emotions? I think that if this court were to say you have to have a legal description in every condemnation petition, that's the kind of problem that would come up every once in a while. And I think it's a public safety issue, and it's a lot better to do it in an orderly manner. Thank you very much.
First of all, the statement that you could only build one house on this 40-acre tract under the A2 zoning is disrespectful of the truth. You can look at the A2 zoning, you can look at Story's own appraisers' conclusions, his own testimony, which we have cited in our briefing, that says under this A2 zoning, you have the right under the zoning to build one house for 10 acres on Story's 40-acre tract. Story's appraiser did not appraise the property based on a use for one resident, based on the petition or anything in the petition. He testified that he relied on a phone call to Story to determine that there was going to be one residence on the property. That's the immediate possession hearing transcript at page 122. The statutes, section 38.1105, subsection 3 and 4, indicate that the uses and purposes, that at the end of the case, The condemnor gets essentially a conveyance of property. The rule and order that is entered at the end of an eminent domain case is in effect a conveyance of property, like a deed. And that conveyance of property gives the condemnor the uses and purposes set forth in the petition. For a deed, you need specificity. That's why we believe that read as a whole, the statutes require specificity in the petition with respect to uses and purposes. Story's testimony was that she did not take the short route through the Bly's property, and we've cited this in our briefing, because it was very expensive to build a road there. She put on expert testimony that it was very expensive to build a road there. This court in the Berglund case already concluded that the cost method is an accepted method of reaching market value. The Court of Appeals ignores that. The Shields case, which we have cited in our briefing from the Washington Appellate Court, also looks to an allocation of the price, taking the cost of the construction and allocating it among the users. And the Shields case says that makes sense because in the private marketplace, that's what a third party would do when they are purchasing an access easement. They would look at putting something extra for an existing road. Thank you very much.
I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. The case will